Dr. Jessica Grisham returns to Conversations today. Jessica is Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of New South Wales, and she specialises in researching and treating anxiety disorders like hoarding, which she talked about last time she was here. Jessica has also dived deep into the world of obsessive compulsive disorder, which is one of the most debilitating illnesses anyone can have. And it's not the same as being a bit of a neat freak or a mad Bulldogs fan. People who have OCD are often tormented with terrible thoughts that are completely counter to their character. And they begin to wonder, which is the real me? Is it the me who has these terrifying thoughts? Or is it the me who's horrified by them? Often they become so afraid of their thoughts being real that they hide from the world just in case. And they can become locked in a cycle of trying to appease or to ward off their thoughts with compulsive rituals. But Jessica Grisham wants us to understand that this is a treatable disorder and there are proven workable therapies to help lift this horrible burden. Hi, Jessica. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
What are some of the major behaviours that point to someone having obsessive compulsive disorder?
Probably the behaviours that would lead you to suspect someone has OCD would be repetitive checking or repetitive washing. Anytime you see someone doing something over and over again and continuing to feel anxious until they repeat that behavior many, many times. So people with checking compulsions, for example, might check their house repeatedly to make sure it's locked, but then they go to work, still feel tormented by the doubts, and would drive back to their house multiple times to check that the door was locked. And this taking up a great portion of someone's day and really a lot of their preoccupied with their mental energy.
So this is going beyond something that I've done, which is you drive out the driveway, go down the road, and you go, did I leave the iron on? And you go back and you know you didn't leave the iron, but you have to know. And so you check and you didn't leave the iron on.
Yes.
The difference between that is that you go back again and again, go back several times to check.
Yeah, so I think the duration and the frequency. We all do have those absent-minded moments. I know I do, where you have to check something a couple times or you're not quite confident in your memory. But imagining that amplified by thousands and that you're constantly haunted by this dread that you haven't done something and that something terrible is going to happen, and spending much of your day ensuring that these terrible things don't happen, it's quite a different experience, I think, than what most of us experience day to day.
Yeah. How is it different from like general anxiety that a lot of people experience?
One important difference is that people with generalized anxiety disorder worry about day-to-day things, kind of the quotidian life. They worry about what their finances and their job. It's the same kinds of things, again, that we worry about, but to a greater extent, and causing them more difficulty controlling those worries and more problems with sleep, etc. With someone with OCD, the worries that they have don't really feel so normal to them. They feel like they're alien to the person. And I think you put it really nicely in the beginning. They're alien to who they see themselves as being. They might have a thought that they're going to sleepwalk and strangle their children in their sleep, or that they're going to stab a loved one, or they might have an intrusive sexual image that's very unpleasant, not arousing, but very unpleasant, like their elderly grandparents having sex. So these types of thoughts feel very different to someone with GAD who might just worry about things, and the thoughts seem very consistent with who they are. Oh, I'm worried about my bills. I might fall behind. These kinds of thoughts would feel quite shocking and disturbing and intrusive to the person.
Is it a kind of disease of the modern world, or does it pop up in, I don't know, literature going back a bit further back under a different name?
It does. It goes back in. I think some of the earliest texts have to do with priests who struggle with excessive scrupulosity, they called it, and repeated confessing. There was a famous priest in Naples who is actually, I think, the patron saint of confession, Alfonso Liguria. And the other priests in Naples would just go running when they would see him approach because he was so, and it was minor things.
Here he comes again, right?
Yes, here he comes again. He wants to confess to having a breadcrumb in his tooth before he took confession, or he wants to confess that very minor things, but this drive to continue confessing.
It used to be called the doubting disease, didn't it? That's not a bad name for it in some ways, is it?
Yeah, it is. It's not a bad name for it at all, because I think it really captures that sensation people have. Another way to describe it has been not just right sensation. And there is some possible neural mechanism behind that. But that people with OCD describing having this paralyzing doubt that they just can't move on until they've checked that 100th time, or until they've washed for another hour. And it's just that feeling of not quite right.
When you divide it down into different forms of OCD, I know these things aren't like very, you know, utterly discrete categories, but how do what sort of general forms do they tend to take? Does OCD tend to take?
Well, it's one of the most fascinating thing about OCD is that it is a very heterogeneous disorder, and there are these different symptom dimensions. So two people with OCD can look very, very different. And some of the most common ones we see are washing and contamination. So people feeling constantly that they might die or have some terrible disease or might spread some terrible disease. So spending hours and hours washing themselves. I've had clients who've spent, including adolescent clients who spent hours every day in the shower trying to decontaminate themselves and their homes. So that's a very common presentation. Other presentations are the doubting and checking that I described. So checking the stove repeatedly, checking the lock repeatedly, just not quite sure that something bad might happen. It might be outlets. I had a client who would stay behind at work and walk around the building, not just her office, but everyone's office, and make sure everything was unplugged and do that multiple times because she would have the thought that maybe there'll be a fire. And if there is, it will be my fault. And so she would feel personally responsible for long periods of checking to make sure that didn't happen. So that would be another subtype. And then the other one that we have talked about a little bit is that forbidden thoughts. So this is the sexual and religious, these kinds of abhorrent thoughts that people have that aren't consistent, as you said, with who they are, what they really believe, but are just the most appalling thing that they can imagine popping into their mind. It might be a religious figure that is important to them doing something obscene. That would be an example of one of these forbidden thought type dimension.
How about the kind of OCD that makes people straighten pictures or line up the remote controls on the couch just so? Is that a kind of OCD?
Yes. So there can be variance in personality. Lots of people just are a bit tidier or like things a little bit more orderly, and that is not in and of itself OCD. But there is a subtype of OCD where people become overly involved in symmetry and ordering. So they need to have things in a certain way or it's lined up in a certain way or they can't function, they can't move on. So there'd be people who would be spending hours again putting things in a seemingly arbitrary order, but they don't feel right. Again, they feel that not just right sensation until it's exactly how it needs to be.
The things they all seem to have in common to me, we were just hearing you speak like this, they all sound like people who are being badly bullied or tyrannized by something.
That's a really good analogy, and it's something that we use in treatment, particularly with adolescents and kids with OCD, is trying to separate out the OCD from themselves, and sometimes we give it a personality or even a name to kind of capture that sense that this is a bully that's pushing you around. It's very opportunistic. It's detecting what's most upsetting to you, and it's really pushing you to do a whole bunch of things in response. And it's very sneaky. So we'll say things like, the OCD will tell you, just check one more time. Why not? It's not going to hurt anyone to check another time. And if you do, then your aunt won't die in a terrible accident. So what's the harm? Check three more times. And it's very seductive in that way. So part of treatment is kind of learning to stand up to that bully. I think that's a good way to put it.
That's why it sort of elicits this feeling of incredible sympathy from me. I just feel like someone's being tyrannized here without a visible tyrant in sight. The thoughts of are doing the tyrannizing.
And that's important for the person to realize, because sometimes we say it's a false friend. They think the OCD voice is actually helping them, protecting them from doing something terrible. Now, if you do these terrible things won't happen. As soon as you recognize it's a false friend, it's a bully, it's a good step towards treatment.
What about the kind of obsessive behavior that you know, means you've got to collect every baseball card or every kind of figurine? That kind of collector's obsessive mentality. Is that when you put it like this, maybe that's not OCD. What is that anyway?
It's not. That's not necessarily any type of psychopathology.
No.
It might be.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
Unless it gets out of control, and then it might go towards hoarding, which we talked about in last show. But certainly we don't want to start stigmatizing people being excited about things and passionate and collecting. And also the interesting, important distinction is when you're collecting things, it feels good. It feels part of who you are and reflects your true self. Whereas OCD is actually the opposite. These thoughts you're having feel very contrary to who you are.
Yes, there's no pleasure in it.
No pleasure at all.
I mean, I suppose we want to look at neurological reasons, trying to get into the brain chemistry and electricity to try and figure out what's going on there. What do we actually know about what's going on in the brain of someone who's suffering from OCD, Jessica?
There's been some very interesting research over the last few decades that's identified that there's possibly a difference in a particular neural circuit in the brain. And it looks like the front part of the brain that communicates the deeper structures in the brain, that there might be something hyperactive in that circuit. So what's interesting is that that part of the brain is involved in detecting errors and perseveration of behavior. So in someone without OCD, you might be in the garden and touch something really dirty, hand in fertilizer, and you have an impulse to wash your hands. That would come from this circuit. But then after you've washed your hands, the circuit would be completed and you would have that sense of finished. So in OCD, part of what we've identified is that circuit is continuing to reverberate. So even if you've washed your hands, you're still getting that signal, not finished, need to correct. And that might be contributing to that sense that someone's washed their hands, but they're going to go back and wash them again and wash them again.
Is neuroplastic theory helpful in this matter? Because I wonder if it sounds like if it's possibly caused by this kind of glitch in the wiring of the brain, if new neural pathways can be built to actually get around this or deal with this problem.
I think it's probably a little reductionist to blame the whole thing on the neural circuit. So while we think that contributes, there's definitely a lot we don't know and other factors involved. But to your question about changing these circuits, that's one of the really exciting things that we've observed as well, is that if you observe this hyperactivity in the brain of someone with OCD, looking at pictures of the brain, you see this is hyperactive. That person undergoing behavioral treatment for OCD will have a reduction in that circuit after treatment, and the same kind of reduction that you would see with medication. So purely doing things and learning and talking to someone can actually change the functioning of your brain in a way that's more adaptive. So it's not kind of a static thing.
So it's not about the alarm signal, the kind of fizzing alarm signal you're talking about. It's the failure to switch that off that's
yes.
The problem here in this case. Is it episodic? Like, you know, does it come and go like, you know, depression or bipolar disorder or things like that?
I think it's less episodic than depression. Of course, people experience fluctuations in how severe it is. There might be times in people's life where it's more or less severe, but it tends to be more chronic unless someone gets treatment.
Does it ever go away without treatment?
Rarely. So it is the kind of thing that would spontaneously remit very rarely. And so this is another reason it's really important for people to know that there is treatment available.
So you need another person, in other words, to help you to get out of that cycle of your own thoughts?
I would say in most cases you do. There are probably anecdotes of people who have, through their own reading or through their own work, been able to overcome. But in most cases, it's really seeking out professional treatment.
The kind of intrusive thoughts you were talking about earlier, the ones that are really troubling for the person with OCD, the one, you know, whether maybe sex with people they shouldn't be having sex with, definitely not be having sex with, that kind of thing, or I want to kill my child, or that kind of awful thought like that. Are these random just thought bubbles from nowhere, or do they have a deeper meaning?
The deeper meaning is usually the opposite of what the patient fears it is, and this is part of what we talk about in treatment. So the patient might have a thought that they're going to harm their loved one, and they think the deeper meaning is that they're evil, they're a bad person, maybe they secretly hate their children. But what we talk about in treatment is the deeper meaning is usually that this is the worst thing that you can imagine. If you're not a religious person and you have an obscene image of a religious figure, you might just be a little perplexed and it would pass on through. But if you care deeply about your religion and that religious figure, you have this obscene image, it is extremely distressing. So by the very fact that it's bothering you and it's getting caught in this net of OCD and caught in your brain and cycling around is more, for us, what we talk about, an indication that it's completely opposite of who you really are and your true values.
When I was thinking about this, I was thinking, you know, I used to live in the comedy world, Jessica, and after the gig, comedians will sometimes get together in a bar somewhere, and this is a comedian's only thing that tends to happen, and they'll do this thing where you try and one-up each other by saying the worst possible thing that you can possibly imagine, terrible things that are completely unbroadcastable, I'm afraid, to one another. And it's kind of like, what about this? And it's definitely not something you want civilians to overhear because they'd be really frightened and appalled. But they're not real thoughts. It's kind of like, if you say this terrible, terrible thing as it passes through your mind and you put it out in front of everyone like an ugly mess and laugh at it, that's a way of dealing with it. What do you think about all that?
I think that's wonderful to hear because it's really interesting, first of all, not being in the comedy world, but also it's really consistent with what we tell clients, that these terrible ideas that pass through your mind, and we all have intrusive thoughts, that keeping them there and continuing to think about what they might mean and suppressing them and hiding them and feeling such terrible shame about them gives those thoughts more power over you and your life, and makes them keep coming back. Whereas what you're saying with the comedians about just letting it out, spitting that terrible thought out and putting it out for the world to see kind of takes the power away from it, I think. It kind of says, this is a random, terrible, ridiculous thought I had, and let's all just put it out there and laugh at it, rather than starting to give it more power than it deserves.
Yeah, it's kind of like the kind of laughter that's elicited when a baby, you know, vomits yogurt all over the front of you. You know, that kind of disgusting mess. It's kind of funny, you know. It's a terrible thing. I suppose it's the process of letting the thought pass, is it? Is that what it is? You let the thought enter the mind, go down into the mouth, pop it out into the world, and then it's gone.
Yes.
It's gone.
Ideally, and sometimes that's a lot easier said than done, but ideally that's what we're trying to encourage, is that not struggling with these thoughts, letting go with the struggle, putting them out into the world, and in therapy, putting out in the world by telling your therapist or by imagining these scenarios that seem so upsetting and not suppressing them is really important.
So is this the heart of the anxiety for the OCD sufferer, is that the thoughts pop in and you wonder, is that thought the real me? Or what is that? What is the real me? There's this tension between the thought and the thought that's horrified by it.
Yes, I think that's a large portion. There is also, this means that someone is going to die or be harmed in some way, and that will be my fault. So there's other things that are going on, but this fear of the dark self is definitely something that seems to cut across presentations.
So it's not just a spiritual crisis. It's the fear of real world consequences.
It's both. Yeah. So I think I might secretly be a terrible sadistic person because I had this thought. And there's also, I had an image of my family burning in a house in flame. And if I don't run back and check a million times, they will all die in flames. And that will be my fault.
Yeah. But how often do you find someone with OCD, as opposed to someone who's, you know, probably horribly psychotic, actually will act on these terrible thoughts?
Never. So that's the nature of the disorder. Someone with OCD who imagines that they're going to stab their husband and does a whole lot of rituals about hiding their knives and not wanting them to have any knives in the kitchen and a lot of checking behavior to make sure, that is exactly the person that will never, ever stab their husband. They are so appalled by this thought. It's an intrusive, obsessional thought, versus someone who is actually violent, who wants to, who feels tempted by or angered by someone and wants to hurt them. That's a very different picture.
Tell me about then the compulsions, the C part of OCD. What's their function for the person who's going through OCD anyway?
Their function in the short term is that they make the person feel better. And this is, again, kind of the trap that we get into. And when we talk to people, we understand that if you were feeling really anxious and distraught and guilty about a thought, and you knew that tapping 12 times and saying 3 prayers would make you feel better, who wouldn't do that? And that's part of the trap. So the function is that in the short term, it makes you feel a whole hell of a lot better. Your anxiety goes down, your distress goes down. And that's the problem, because then it's reinforced. It's what we call negative reinforcement. Then the next time you have that thought, you need to do it again and again and again. And it's very hard to resist, but the resisting is the key.
Is the compulsion part, the ritual part of it, a distraction or a ritual of appeasement to something? What is that?
I think it's
anyway?
More the latter. It's more than distraction. It's more that somehow magically me saying these particular sentences, tapping in this particular way, will prevent this terrible thing from happening. And when you ask people with OCD, they're quite sensible, lovely people, and they realize that there's a bit of a magical component to that. And yet they can't shake the feeling that if they just do this thing, yes, it sounds a little silly, but if they just do this thing, they'll prevent this terrible outcome.
And it gives short-term relief from the anxiety.
Short-term feeling better and maintaining the problem.
But over time, once this all adds up, what then?
What then is that they're trapped in the cycle. Every time they feel bad, they won't allow themselves to test the possibility that this terrible thing will happen by not doing the compulsion.
And what's the range of compulsive rituals you've seen?
There's been a fair amount of the common physical ones of checking and, as I said, checking stoves, checking doors, checking outlets, and a lot of washing and scrubbing. And then there's been more idiosyncratic ones, like a client with concerns about obsessive thoughts about getting lice, doing a lot of inspecting of her hair, inspecting of her children's hair, those kinds of rituals. And some people have rituals that are less physical and less obvious. There might be mental rituals. You could be interviewing a client and there's a sudden pause, and later on you find out that during that pause, they're repeating a phrase or a set series of phrases in their mind over and over again as their ritual, as their compulsion.
Oh, like a prayer.
Like a prayer.
Right.
Yep.
Like a Hail Mary type thing or something like that.
Right, but something that's not driven by devotion, but by anxiety.
Right. And would it be a prayer, or could it be anything? Could it be just be any set of reassuring words?
It could be anything, and it's very idiosyncratic to the individual. So we have seen people who would use prayer. But it's, again, important to disentangle the prayer that they're doing due to their religious beliefs and expression of devotion to the repeated prayers that they're doing to reduce the anxiety associated with this bad thought.
Ah, and if they're doing that in a ritual, then that's not visible, is it?
It's not visible.
No. And that's a harder thing to recognize and then acknowledge and then treat, because I don't suppose you feel you need to own up to it then.
Right. And you might be very ashamed. It might be part of the general shame you have about the OCD. So it's important to investigate and question people and see if you can get them to talk about it.
Jessica, how big is shame a factor in OCD?
I think it's huge. I think people have shame for the specific thoughts that they have. Lots of the ones I described, these kinds of not arousing sexual thoughts that are disturbing, or religious thoughts that are against their religion, those kinds of blasphemous thoughts. So they're disturbed by the content of the thoughts, and then they're disturbed by having the disorder. So there's people who have severe OCD who have hidden it from their family members for years. They do their rituals in private, and they have such a terrible shame that they don't want people to know that they have the disorder or that they have these bad thoughts.
And what lengths will people go to hide these rituals?
There's people who would stay in their home most of the day because they don't want to leave their house and have people see them doing their checking, doing their repeating, doing their tapping. There's people who've ended relationships so the other person won't find out. And it can be something prevents people from working. It's very disabling in that seat.
As you say that, I can just see how easily it could be misdiagnosed as, you know, agoraphobia or something else like that. Is that a problem too?
I think if you, with a skilled clinician, you could work it out reasonably quickly. But if the person's not willing to communicate their thoughts, and it could be tricky.
Jessica, one of your early clients had an irrational belief that she was diseased, that she'd contracted HIV. Mm. What was going on there? Tell me how that unfolded, how she came to believe that.
As it often is, the paradox is that she was a very lovely, sweet, quite shy person who'd had very few romantic relationships in her life. Just a really, really lovely lady. And yet she had the obsessional thought that she might have contracted HIV. And the reality was that the likelihood of that happening was extremely, extremely slim. But for her, because she was quite a religious, conservative, conscrupulous person, the idea that she might have contracted an STD was pretty much the worst thing she could imagine.
Can I just ask, was there actual sexual congress involved here?
I think there might have been same sexual congress once or twice in a period over a period of 10 or 20 in her entire life. But what made it most unlikely is that she had been tested for HIV multiple times. This became her compulsion. She would repeatedly go to the clinic and have a blood test for HIV. The test would always be negative every single time. And yet when she would come home, she would start, the doubt would come back, the dread, the doubt, that feeling of anxiety. And she would go back and have more tests. And what I thought was even more fascinating is in a drawer next to her bed, she would keep the results of these multiple HIV tests and have the doubting thought, but maybe I read it wrong. Maybe I didn't look quite carefully enough. Maybe there's something else on this document that says that I do have HIV. And then she would get her papers out and reread and reread and reread. And it was just so painful to watch, because it was a very intelligent person, and she was just trapped in this cycle of fearing that she has HIV with no evidence.
I'm really reluctant to try and psychoanalyze it from a distance, but could she possibly have been thinking deep down that, I don't know, that somehow she deserved to have HIV?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's always been possible to kind of speculate about what is going on deep down. And
she said she's religious and she's having sex outside of marriage here in this case.
Right, yeah. Right. So there might be some more broad, and we do see that with some clients who are very religious, and any sexual activity makes them feel so guilty and so immoral that further fuels the OCD.
I wonder if some cruel person had got hold of those reports and retyped them to show positive, you know, you are HIV positive, and slipped it surreptitiously back in her drawer, and she'd seen it, and she's seen that report. Would she have been horrified or even relieved? I wonder.
I kind of get where you're going with the latter, because I can see where actually the not knowing and the constant doubting is the worst hell of all for her.
So once the worst thing would happen, then maybe, oh, thank God that's over then, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's all speculation, but in a little, it's part of the spirit of that capture is what we do in exposure, and especially imagining the worst outcome. It's like if you allow yourself to imagine actually having HIV or dying of HIV, in a way it's freeing to just, as you said, imagine the worst and sit with it rather than constantly hiding from and tormenting yourself with the doubt.
And when she was telling you about this, was she trying to persuade you what she was doing was reasonable?
She had a reasonable amount of insight, so she knew that it was excessive and yet couldn't stop. But we do have some clients who might have less insight who would think this seems to be reasonable lengths to go through.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
How long do people tend to suffer in silence with OCD before they actually seek out help?
Sadly, it can be a decade or more. There are people who've come in.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, that's terrible. After a decade of this. And they must be in a terrible state once it's come to that.
It can really take a lot away from their lives. And I think it will come to treatment shortly, but I think that's a really important thing to think about, because oftentimes when we describe the treatment to lay people, it sounds icky and it sounds horrible and it sounds stressful, or even the students that we're training as psychologists. So always try and get people to refocus on how much of people's lives they lose to OCD, they lose to the disorder. And that really helps put in perspective why doing these things that might seem silly or might seem icky or might seem a bit extreme is worth it if it helps them get their life back from this disorder that is preventing them from having relationships or having children or getting married or working.
How treatable is OCD? I mean, is it something you talk of in terms of something you can cure or just alleviate? Or what? How do you talk about that?
The treatments we have for OCD are very, very good and in many cases can be considered a cure. So roughly 3/4 of people who go through these treatments end up benefiting greatly and having their lives better and being back to functioning individuals. So there may be, in some cases, a few lingering symptoms, but most of the time people are able to resume their daily lives and in most senses functionally cured.
When someone who's been suffering from OCD for a while shows up and is talking with you, what are the questions they want to ask you? What do they want to know?
I think they want to know, is this normal? What's wrong with me? And it's really just such a huge, brave first step that actually talking to someone about it in the first instance is its own form of treatment. Because I think what people want to know is, you know, am I crazy? What could possibly be going wrong with me that I'm having these thoughts? Am I really a bad person? And testing it out with another human who's maybe the first human to hear this, who doesn't say, oh, yes, you clearly are a terrible, crazy person. We need to lock you away. And just hears it and empathetically and says, yeah, I think that in itself is a huge first step for people.
Yeah. And how about finding out that not the only one in the world is going through this
stuff? Yes, absolutely. That's huge as well. I mean, there's a whole interesting debate about stigma and naming disorders. But for a lot of people, I think, who've had OCD for a long time, giving it a name and knowing that it is something that they struggle with, but it is not them, it does not define them, is really important. We have a conference there's an international OCD conference, and I think that's one of the coolest things about the conference is because therapists go, researchers go, but also people with OCD go, and their families and kids with OCD go. And they all come together and they see what's going on with the research and the treatment, and they have dinner together and they chat together, and the kids go into different activity groups and they do not perfect drawings together. And it's really lovely because just to see the connection of the community, because I think you're right, it's huge to know you're not alone.
Yeah, it's also so interesting too. That's the other thing. It tells us so much about what it means to be human, I think, in a way.
Yeah.
I suppose once people come to you or come to anyone for treatment, they would have burnt out a lot of relationships insofar as a lot of the behaviours that are associated with the checking and the like with OCD are niggling and irritating and lead people to wear out their welcome with the rest of the people around them, I suppose. So you often find these people are quite isolated.
They might be quite isolated, or in some cases we see family members who've been sucked into the OCD, who now serve as they execute the compulsions for the person.
For a quiet life.
Yeah.
Really? Just so they can get through the day?
And they think they're helping. So they might have a child with OCD who they'll spend hours cleaning for them or checking for them or reassuring. I've had clients like this where the parents are at such a loss, and it is such a hard, hard thing to see your kids struggle with, that they just engage in the compulsions with the kid. I'll check your book. I'll recheck your book. I'll put it in this bag, and then I'll put it in this sack, and then I'll put it on the shelf and make sure it doesn't touch.
Yeah, that's what parents do, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's what you do. You sort of try and
Not be upset. Yeah. And for them, that can involve just becoming another part of the ritual. So part
an
of it is...
an accomplice to it.
An accomplice, yeah. Exactly.
You treat it with something called exposure response prevention. What's the idea behind exposure response prevention therapy?
The idea behind exposure response prevention, it came from animal models. So we knew for quite a while in the 50s and 60s that if you put an animal in a feared situation and you don't let them avoid, they can learn that certain situations are safe. But everyone was pretty afraid to try this approach with humans and humans with anxiety disorders. So there was a very brave clinician named Victor Meyer. And I think he was a World War II fighter pilot and had been a prisoner of war. So my thinking is possibly that allowed him to be a bit braver than other people had been at that point. And he had two cases of very severe OCD in his hospital. One who had that contamination washing, who was spending all day washing and fearing germs and fearing that she would die of some disease from germs. And another who had sexual obscene thoughts that were extremely distressing, that she would take her 6 hours to get dressed because of the compulsion she would do. And he was the first person to implement exposure response prevention, where he would bring on these thoughts, situations that made those thoughts come up, made those thoughts worse, and get the clients not to engage in the behaviors, not to do the compulsions, and he had great success. So both of those clients, even though they weren't fully 100%, they still had a few symptoms remaining, they were able to take their lives back. They were able to begin functioning again. And that was kind of the beginning of exposure response prevention as we know it.
So exposing the person to the subject or object of their fear.
Yes.
Is that still considered cruel?
I think that there are some people who fear that it's cruel, and I would argue that's often a lack of understanding or education of two things. First of all, again, the costs of the disorder prior to this treatment, but secondly, the way in which we do it. So the client is always in charge. We never do anything without the client's permission. They understand the process and they choose the rate at which they progress through it. So it's never us forcing anything on someone. They believe it will help them and then they'll engage and do it. And the other thing is that...
So you're not throwing them into the deep ends then?
We're not throwing them into the deep end.
You sort of paddle out into the deep end.
You paddle out at your own pace. And I think what sometimes gets a short shrift in all the talk about, oh, it's so scary and it's so intense and this exposure response prevention, which granted it is quite challenging, is how exciting and empowering it can also be. So some clients, for the first time when they do something, like I can think of sessions where I've stood in a bathroom with clients and we've touched the countertops and the sinks and the everything that they feared for hours. And at the end, they feel a reduction of anxiety. And the way that they feel about the bravery that they've shown and how it's kind of challenged these really scary, scary situations they've been struggling with can be quite an exciting part of treatment as well.
As you've been talking about the kind of compulsions that include the cleanliness ones, it's just brought to mind the numerous ads I see on TV for cleaning products that talk about making your home or your kitchen surface 100% germ-free.
Yes.
I wonder, is there a creepy conversation going on there? Are advertisers trying to talk to people with OCD when they do that?
I don't know if it's deliberate, but we certainly find it unhelpful. and we do talk about it in the field. Because one thing that you have to embrace when you do exposures, and I think you have to embrace as being a person living in the world, is that we cannot eliminate risk 100%.
It's a dirty world.
It's a dirty world. And there is nothing that's 100% clean, and there's nothing that's 100% safe, right? So clients who want you to promise them, okay, I'll do this exposure if you promise me that I won't do this, that it will be safe. That's not how it works. You can't guarantee them.
Using someone with this kind of contamination, OCD as an example, you mentioned a woman who was terribly worried about lice. Tell me about her.
She was many, many years ago, and I've changed some details of her case as all the cases I have. But the thing that was interesting about her, she was one of my very first clients and had had a single incident with one of her children contracting lice, or NITs as they call them here. Mm-hmm. And whereas that's never a fun thing for any parent, she became extremely preoccupied and started having lots of obsessive thoughts about lice. And it took over her life in the sense that she wanted to keep her children home from school. She used to be a music teacher and didn't want to teach because she was afraid the lice would come in. She didn't want to go shopping because there might be lice that she would be in the clothing that she would try on. And she would just be overcome with anxiety and fear and dread about an outcome that, again, was not pleasant but is not the end of the world.
So how did you start to treat that?
So we did have a what we call a hierarchy where we built certain steps increasing her ability to do these things. And the key thing with these steps is that you do the thing that's really scary at that step. So one of the steps would be going to a department store and trying on hats. That might be a moderate step for her. But the key thing is that afterwards you don't do your ritual, your compulsion. So you can't go try on your hats and then go immediately into the drugstore, buy every lice decontamination product you can see and take a 10-hour shower. That would not work.
But what do you do? Do you then have to stand next to her and go, don't? Or what do you do? I mean, how do you stop her from doing that?
That's the client has to buy in. They have to believe the rationale, be ready to try to sit with their anxiety and go home and eat a sandwich and go to bed and not take that shower and not get the lice products out and not the lice comb.
And how do they treat you then if you're the person who's saying, you really mustn't do this? Are you like
the teacher
really then?
It's a really interesting relationship because you...
You'd be like mum or dad.
And you care about these clients and you form a rapport with them and a connection. And that's, I think, really key. They know, they trust you. They believe that you're not trying to harm them and you really want to help them. And then there are moments when you might seem harsh and it's unpleasant too because you do care about these people. So one of my final sessions with her, she was brushing her hair with an unknown hairbrush. And I remember her sitting there and just crying and being so anxious. And I felt miserable. I was probably quite a young clinician at the time. And we both sat there and felt miserable and just had to be in that emotion and be in that moment because ultimately, after that time passed, she did get better.
So if she does try on the hat and then she does use the unknown hairbrush, which is quite frankly scary, and she does do that, and then she does go home and have a sandwich and she does go to bed and doesn't do the ritual, how does she feel the next day?
I can only speak to that in that particular thing. She feels, I think, a bit proud, a bit pleased with herself and not completely, there's still more work to be done, but the worst didn't happen. And the other thing that's interesting with that lice scenario is what if it did happen? And then this thing, it reminds me of what you were talking about with the comedians, this thing that you've built up as this horrible scenario happens. And if you realize it's not the end of the world that you thought it was and that you bravely did these things that resulted in this and that you can cope.
Does this have something to do with allowing yourself to be vulnerable?
I think all exposure therapy and anxiety, there is a piece of that. It's being brave, being vulnerable, taking some risks for something that's important to you.
Yeah, that's the essence of being brave, is being vulnerable, I suppose, isn't it? What might you do, though, in a case of harm OCD, where the person with OCD is having these awful thoughts about harming other people or themselves? I mean, exposure therapy can't work in that case, can it?
It works, and it works because they are then avoiding situations that they're afraid that they might harm. These are people with no history of violence, no anger problems, and no actual risk.
Who are horrified by this. It is completely counter to their character, but nonetheless the thought pops in that to go and do this terrible thing. What do you expose them to?
Let's take the knife lady, for example. Who's gotten rid of all sharp objects and knives from her house because she's had intrusive images of stabbing her husband. Not angry, healthy marriage, just these intrusive images. You might have her initially get knives back in the house. Then you might have her holding a knife. Then you might have her holding a knife to her husband's throat. That might be the very top of the hierarchy for her. So sitting there and allowing herself to feel that anxiety, and the anxiety subsides, the worst thing doesn't happen because it was never going to, could be a really powerful end of treatment kind of thing.
Do people ever burst out laughing with relief after this, or is it more just like, oh?
There are moments of humor. There are moments of humor, yeah.
What about the compulsion aspect? I'm guessing you can't embarrass them into giving up their compulsions. You can't sort of shame them into doing that. Wouldn't be right, would it? So what do you do about that?
I think that's all in how you explain what we know about OCD and what makes it better. So it's not about shaming them at all. It's about saying that explaining that this compulsion makes you feel better, but it's dragging this problem out. It's exactly the false friend telling you, just do this one more thing and you'll be fine. And once they believe the rationale, then not doing the compulsion is because they choose not to do it because they know that it's making them worse in the long run.
Once the horrible, terrifying thought has been cycled through again and again and again and again, and it's been exposed, you've exposed, does it just sort of then fades into the background? It sort of becomes part of the white noise of life? Is that what it is?
That's the ideal scenario, and that's, we do talk about it as white noise. That's another metaphor we use, because what we are trying to get them to do is pay attention to, we use a radio metaphor since we're on the radio, the true signal, which is who they really are, what they really believe, what they do in their life, from the static, from the noise, the white noise or the static on the radio. And we talk about how the obsessions are static, and starting to identify them as such hopefully lets them do, as you say, notice it as static and let it keep going.
Part of me, it seems to be like a misfiring creative impulse in a way. I mean, you know, a crime novelist has to imagine the most awful things at times and actually commit them to the page. And then quite often once they've written, you know, like Val McDermott will say, right, so it's awful, grisly murder. And we go, oh dear, where did that come from?
Yes.
But it doesn't really trouble her that much. Well, I don't know if it troubles her so much, but she's certainly accepting of it and understanding of it. It seems like a misfiring of some kind of creative impulse.
Well, it's a fascinating area that I'm kind of getting into some research, which is imagery in OCD, because a lot of these things aren't just thoughts. They're vivid, visceral, intense images. And so we're kind of starting to investigate the imagination of people of OCD. Mm. Is it that they can more vividly imagine these terrible things happening? And if you more vividly imagine them, that would make you be more fearful and more likely to do compulsion. So it's a new area, but there's some evidence of that, and also some possibility that that can be used in terms of the treatment.
I mean, but sometimes if I've had a terrible nightmare, I've been told by somebody who knows a bit about psychology, this is really your subconscious mind just trying to get your attention about something, mm-hmm. by frightening you. It's reaching around in the cupboard, grabbing all kinds of images that are and putting them all together and creating a monster and throwing it at you to say, pay attention to this. Mm. Is it something like that? Is that something that process at work with the subconscious minds, Jessica?
I think there is something about the opportunistic nature of OCD glomming on to a general sense of anxiety. So I do believe there is that kind of, and that can be shown if people are in a stressful situation or someone with OCD is having a lot of a hard time, the OCD might look around for something and latch onto it and then say, you know, I think that what's going on is you're having obscene urges towards this inappropriate person. That's what's happening. And it's kind of perpetuated that way.
I'm coming now to a question that often I talk about with authors, fiction authors all the time, which is, do you own your thoughts? This is maybe we get into a whole other area here, and I don't know if this is within the remit of psychology at all, but there is this thought, the harming thought, mm-hmm. and there's the larger thought or the larger self that recoils in horror at this, but that thought is still in your head. I mean, do we own our thoughts? What do you think about all that?
I think that is, you're right, it's a broader philosophical and tradition and a religious tradition. So if you look at different religious texts, they have different ideas about this that we've had over the ages. So in some religions and certain types of Christianity, you do own your thought, and it is focused on the intentions you have and the thoughts that you cross your mind, that you're responsible for them and having a pure mind. Whereas other religions, possibly more helpfully in the OCD context, are more about what you crosses your mind is not as important as what you do and your deed. The deed is more important than the intent. So I think it is an interesting philosophical question, but we also try and disentangle what are our deliberate thoughts in OCD, like what we're choosing to think about and engaging with, versus intrusive thoughts, which I don't think it's helpful for people with OCD to own those thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't, like I say, probably in the remit of psychology, but I'm just wondering how you as a human being, when you stand back and think about this at the end of the day, what you make of all that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't have to own all our thoughts in the sense of feel responsible for them. I think we can allow our brain a little freedom to be poking around and having things come into our minds and imagination, and that's okay. It doesn't, not everything that occurs to us in our mind we have to take responsibility for.
When we were talking before we started this conversation today, you were saying you really wanted to get across the idea that this is a terrible thing, but it is treatable and treatment is effective. And you can almost look at cures very often in a lot of cases here, as you say. Do people relapse, though? Do they relapse once you've got them through this?
There's a pretty good case that they don't relapse to the extent of having the full disorder. There might be periods where they experience some symptoms, they have to go back to their strategies, but the treatment's pretty powerful and pretty long-lasting when they've done follow-up studies. And I should mention there's also medication treatment that has been found to be effective. So I think the argument is that if you engage in this treatment, you can have some really important successes. And if you do have a relapse, you now have the tools and you can go back and tackle it again.
You mentioned that children with OCD. At what age might OCD start to appear in a kid?
The early age of onset, there can be kids with OCD as young as 8 to 9, 10. Adolescent is a period where a lot of people with OCD report their onset.
Yeah, it must be really tricky to diagnose in children, given that, you know, kids are tricky anyway, aren't
they? Yeah, kids are tricky anyways, and kids have their own little routines and rituals anyways, and kids like to order things and be perfectionistic and have little collections and things like that.
So and live in that world of magical thinking.
And live in that world of magical thinking, exactly. But disentangling when you notice it's becoming a problem and when the child is becoming distressed or isolated or not able to function. And there's some suggestion that OCD that presents when you're a kid is a little different than adult onset OCD, that it might have a slightly different presentation. Might be more repetitive behaviors.
When you work with teenagers, I love this about your work, you actually encourage teenagers to give their OCD a name, don't you?
Yeah.
Like what kinds of names do they give them?
Oh, I'm trying to think of some funny ones we've had. They sometimes name them just like Bob or Sam, but sometimes we try and think of something silly like Poo Poo Head, or adding a little bit of comedy to the situation, which makes it seem less powerful and less scary.
Yeah, it means like you've got some kind of an edge on that voice, perhaps.
Yeah. I'm not taking you quite so seriously.
Yeah, yes. And you mentioned scrupulosity or scruples earlier on. So this is the kind of things we've seen throughout history. How might these scruples be managed by a therapist?
So scruples is when someone has a very rigid and extreme adherence either to religion or can be to their own moral code. So you can see that in OCD sometimes when people become very, very preoccupied about little small things that they might do. And the example of a priest who named Father Santa, who has actually a website about scrupulosity, and he talks about a person who confesses to him repeatedly, "Oh, Father, I've sinned. I laughed in church." And he says, "Why did you laugh in church?" And he said, "Well, Father told a joke." And he says, "Okay." And then he comes back the next week, "Father, I laughed in church. Why did you laugh in church?" "Well, the priest told a joke." And he said, "I think he wants you to laugh." And he said, "Yes, but it's a sin to laugh in church." So this kind of continuing, apparently it's something that priests do struggle with, having certain types of individual scrupulosity where it's not a true sin, but that they're using confession as a repetitive, mechanical way to relieve their anxiety.
This is abuse of the confession booth.
Yeah, so there is some really useful things that happen occasionally when clergy or different religious figures can be involved in therapy and help clients who are religious discriminate, like, between what's truly a product of their religious faith and what the code they should be following and what is probably OCD.
Christianity is an interesting religion to talk about in this case because it enjoins its followers to practice love and forgiveness. But on the other hand, there is a kind of tradition in Christianity that says the thought is the same as the deed.
Right.
Does that play into this scrupulosity and OCD?
It absolutely does. And it's not that we – the important point here is that we don't blame any particular religion for OCD, but what researchers have noticed is the religion can influence the form the OCD takes. So if your religion encourages washing or prayer, that's the form your OCD will take. So we don't think that that religion causes OCD. But it is interesting, this discriminating what your religious system tells you is the thought being a sin, distinguishing a real true thought, again, that reflects the person, and an intrusive thought, which is what we would try and get the person to start distinguishing. An intrusive static thought versus a thought that they're indulging in and reflects their true self.
Jessica, how can you be a good friend or a spouse or partner to someone with OCD that you suspect is going through OCD?
I think encouraging them to get treatment. I think listening to them with an open, empathic connection and showing them that you're not horrified by their thoughts and that we all have those kinds of thoughts and that this might be something that they should get help for.
And the rituals, the compulsive rituals?
I think if you have a person that you love with OCD, working with them not to be an accomplice, as you said, to be a supportive person to them, but not someone who engages with the compulsions and makes things safe for them that actually perpetuates the disorder.
Well, generally speaking, why do you specialize in this area of psychology, of these specific anxiety disorders? What's the point of entry for you that makes it's interesting. It's incredibly interesting, but what is it for you that appeals to you?
I think it is the idiosyncratic, quirky nature of it and maybe this idea that we all have these types of thoughts and it's important to just recognize the varied internal experience we have and not and not be pathologizing or blaming ourselves for our thoughts. It might also just be something as humdrum as my first clients were OCD clients, and I was immediately sucked in by how interesting the presentation was and never looked back.
Are you trying to make the world safe for quirkiness and eccentricity, Jessica?
I do like a bit of quirkiness and eccentricity.
I think that's a banner we can all march behind. I think that's incredibly impressive and utterly delightful. It's fantastic to speak with you about this stuff, and so enlightening as well. This is such an incredible world. I must admit, I thought OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, was, I didn't realize it was such a large world under the surface of all that, because so much, it's a bit of a volcano, this one, isn't it?
It is. There's so much there.
So much running under the surface. It's been such a pleasure once again.
Thank you so much. Pleasure being here.
Jessica Grisham is Associate Professor at the School of Psychology at the University of New South Wales. And she specializes in specific anxiety disorders like hoarding and OCD. And the conversation I did with Jessica on hoarding is on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.